Welcome to our study. We have been studying, as you know, if you've been listening the last few sessions, a series on health and healing. It's a series of about 13 lessons talking about health and healing as presented in scriptures. And we're coming to the end of that series today. This is lesson 13 in this series. And we'd like to begin with a word of prayer. Our kind and loving Father, as always, we seek your presence and your blessing as we speak together, as we think about you, and as we seek to understand your word more clearly. Give us your Holy Spirit to guide us, as our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. This lesson is entitled "The Tie That Binds." And the Bible, in many, many ways, suggests that we were created as beings for friendships, for relationships, for communities. And the focus of this lesson is to find better ways to implement that and thus become more like God. You remember back there at the very beginning, God says, "Let us make man our image, male and female." Remember, and we're supposed to be together. Of course, it's not just the Bible that talks about that. There's a great deal of scientific research demonstrating that humans live better lives, healthier lives, longer lives, happier lives when they're part of a supportive and a loving community. People who feel unloved, lonely, and isolated have 2 to 5 times more illnesses than those who feel connected. Even pregnant women have fewer complications in their pregnancies when they feel loved. And this, I hope it doesn't surprise anyone. Clearly, love and intimacy, connection and community in the social, spiritual, and mental areas lead to greater healing and health. We were created to be together in love and care for each other. Paul says that no one lives and dies for himself alone in Romans 14:7. Unity within the church will prevent us from being tossed about by every wind of doctrine, Paul suggests in Ephesians 4:1-16. Galatians suggests that we are supposed to help carry one another's burdens. So, to Christians who belong to churches, community groups, even small Bible studies, this shouldn't be any surprise at all. You know, Solomon said a long time ago, there is a friend that sticketh closer to than a brother. And how have you found it yourself? Do you find that you're closer to the people who share your beliefs or closer to the people who share your bloodlines, for those of you who have some of each? Anybody want to comment about that?
What do you mean by close? You mean?
Well, I mean, if you share beliefs with people and you go to church with them, maybe you have a Bible study group with them like we have, how close do you feel those people as compared to maybe a relative who's not a church member, doesn't care about Christianity and so forth like that? I haven't investigated.
I'm the one that's the loner in the Christian really community in my family. And it depends on the person. Non-Christians can be loving people. Non-Christians can be condemning people if they decide they don't like the way you're thinking or that you're going to church. So it just depends on the person. In church, you have a bond with people because you come from the same platform, and you can talk to each other at a certain level that is hard to reach with a non-Christian. But I have lovely relatives who are non-Christians, and I think they're Christians, like they are kind, and I have other relatives that I have to pray to God for to help me to love the unlovable. Yes. So, and it just depends.
Paul talks about the church being something like a human body. I mean, think of all the different parts of a human body. And, you know, he says, the eye doesn't say to the ear, I don't need you, or the ear doesn't say to the eye, I don't need you, or the foot or the hand or whatever. And we have all kinds of names. You know, someone who's missing a part is disabled, right? We think they're at a disadvantage of some sort or other. And yet, what about the church? Do we really function? I mean, one of the things about a body is it sticks together. All parts help to support the whole. Do you know any churches that stick together that well? How's that for a challenge?
Well, there wouldn't be a church if they didn't stick together.
Uh-huh.
So there's got to be something that sticks them together.
Yes.
I mean, you've got people who are in the army. They stick together for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Any group sticks together for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
You can name up all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But for a church, there must be a reason.
Yes.
Why people are sticking together.
Yes.
So hope.
Well, yes, Don.
Ken, you have been overseas and away from family and mm-hmm. and all your friends, and yet you made friends over there who are just as close to you as your friends over here at this
yes.
time.
Oh, sir. Yeah. The friends that we, I mean, you have people over there in that kind of circumstance that you are sort of working with, or maybe even they live some distance from you, but that they come and you may even go on vacations together. And after a few years like that, I mean, they're like family members. You know, and we even teach our children to call the parents and another family uncle this and aunt that. So this is a very, it pulls people together. And when we travel someplace, if we go anywhere near somebody that we worked with overseas, we make sure we go see them, visit them. We don't feel comfortable. I mean, we don't have any problem at all saying, I'm coming to your house. I want to stay with you. I mean, you know, and that's not something we would normally do as Americans with just anybody, even in our church group. But it's a question of shared experiences. And I guess that's the question. Do we really feel a real bond, a sharing of experiences with church members?
Well, people come together because of like understandings. Mm-hmm. We can talk to each other about our beliefs.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of what differentiates between denominations, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because they may be Christians, but they may believe slightly different. In one group than another, and these people seem to go to the one that they seem to that matches their experience.
Yeah.
So,
well, since we were born, we have grown up. We've lived in and grown up immersed in sin. We don't have the option of living in a sinless environment. It'd be fun to try for a little while, but we've been immersed in sin. That's We have come to think that that's a normal human experience. But that's not what God intended for us originally. We're supposed to be all living in the Garden of Eden and in a perfect environment. And in that setting, Adam and Eve were created really to be like God. If we said, okay, so that means, logically, that in our time, we originally wish, even though we've come far, far, far away from that original scenario, does that mean that we, in turn, should really be living lives like Jesus? Are we supposed to be like God?
Isn't that the Christian aim?
Yeah.
Isn't that what we're supposed to do?
Have you ever wondered what it would be like if a whole church did that for a while?
You can be in parts of the church that are like that. The mm-hmm. whole church doesn't seem to operate that way, mm-hmm. but different parts are quite functional, and other parts are, as you say, handicapped. But also, that's why the Holy Spirit came after Jesus left, mm-hmm. is to guide us and to educate us as to God's ways.
Now, I'm going to ask you to think for a moment. We look at the life of Jesus. And how did he support himself?
Began with as a carpenter when he really
yeah.
grew up. So
I mean,
but after that, in his ministry, during his ministry,
yeah. How did he support?
During his ministry,
yeah.
Luke 8:1-3 says he was supported by women, apparently wealthy women who mm-hmm. traveled with him and supported him.
So if we all wanted to live lives like Jesus in our day, what should we be doing? Should we all be out traveling and just expect somebody else to support us?
I'd be willing to have some wealthy woman support me.
You're looking at the wrong one.
Okay.
He was the preacher and the pastor, which preachers and pastors are supported by the congregation.
Okay. And, of course, it's not like he did nothing. He was ministering to people all day long.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, I mean, even if they paid a small fee for his services, he would have done quite well.
The great physician.
Yeah.
Yeah, he might have healed some of those women, and they were very grateful.
Well, what keeps us from doing that?
Doing what?
Living lives like Jesus. Got to earn a living. What other things keep us from actually doing
that? Oh, no, but during our living, we're supposed to implement the Christian way during our work.
During our work, okay.
As much as possible. I mean, you can't, within the parameters of what the employer allows, but being kind.
So let me put my question very bluntly in other words. If Jesus were alive on this earth today, what would he do?
It could be a lot different than what we saw,
2,000 years ago.
2,000 years ago, because there's, you know, the culture is different.
Mm-hmm. The environment, situation is different.
But, you know, when you ask that question, you know, why don't we live like he did, do you have anybody in mind, modern example of somebody who has?
No. I wish I did.
You know, I know a few people that do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They tend to do the Lord's work, and they don't seem to worry about, you know, whether they're making enough money or they got a big house to live in and all that kind of thing. There are people that do that.
Yeah, to that extent.
They seem to not be noticed as much, but there are people like that. I think Jesus was noticed because of the miracles he could do,
What would the newspapers do with Jesus today? You ever thought about that? He performs a miracle, and they would be saying, "Okay, what kind of sleight of hand is that? What kind of, you know?" There would be investigative reporters trying to find out whether it had any hidden mics. You know, I mean, what would they do with that?
Today it would go the extreme. It'd be the fanatics that were pro-Jesus, the fanatics anti-Jesus. We're so polarized today. It would be hard to get a balanced news report, as they say, fair and balanced, on what Jesus is doing.
Yeah.
Of course, this is all supposition.
Yeah.
And I think Jesus would live very much like he did when he was here.
Okay. What would he do in Los Angeles? What do you think?
That's real hard to answer because...
That's why I asked you.
Well, we have the history of Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't forget that part.
Mm-hmm.
So then to say what Jesus would do now... I mean, we have so much history of people doing things with sleight of hand, where it wasn't as prominent when Christ was living on this earth. I don't know.
I believe Jesus would do just the same things that he did when he was here before, but he would do it in a different manner.
Mm-hmm. He would adapt it to our situation.
Yes.
Yeah.
As far as he could.
Okay.
Maybe he would be walking up and down Skid Row, and then when he went to the affluent suburbs, he was unable to do miracles in some areas where he lived, right?
He went to Congress, and he told them what he thought of them. Yeah?
We have today some examples of, shall we say, televangelists who take in millions of dollars in contributions, fly around the world in fancy jets, stay in fancy hotels. On their way from here to there, they happen to go by the Riviera for a couple days, etc. I don't think Jesus would be like that.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
I'm convinced that he would not be like that, but I don't know what he would look like today.
Well, since we're talking about health and healing, now let me bring this discussion a little bit now around to our subject. Would Jesus be more comfortable in India, in Africa, in China, in Russia, or in America?
He would be comfortable in all those places because he created them.
Mm-hmm.
And
now, if you were someone walking around speaking to people, you know, not worrying about how you're going to support yourself in India or in Africa, most rural Africa, people wouldn't find that surprising at all.
I suspect that he would have the most skeptics in this mm-hmm. country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he would probably have the most followers in the rural communities mm-hmm. of undeveloped nations.
Well, medical research has shown, interestingly enough, that the people who live the healthiest and happiest lives are the ones who have a wide variety, a very diverse variety of friendships. Now, you may have a lot of friends, but if they're all sort of homogeneous, that's not as beneficial as having a variety of friends. Why do you think that is? And I'm thinking about Jesus. I mean, you suggested he would go from the poor to wealthy. I think he would just move from here to there, and of course he would speak all the languages and so forth like this. We would have trouble following him, I'm sure.
No, psychologists have identified two kinds of people. Some are more outgoing and some are introverts.
Mm-hmm.
What was Jesus? Was he an outgoing person or was he an introvert that had to make himself go out or what?
No, I think he was a very outgoing person.
Yeah.
I think he was about, okay. I would suspect that too.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he understood everybody, the introverts and the extroverts, and he knew how to deal with them all. So it's kind of hard to, depending on what kind of person you are, you know, how would you paint Jesus as far as the painting goes, what he would fit into today, you know?
Okay, well, let's take something from the Bible that might give us some clues about some of the Bible characters. Go to Romans, yeah.
Well, first of all, you said our different types of people give us healthier lives.
Mm-hmm. Having friendships in a variety of different kinds of situations.
Yes. I think that's only true if we are able to understand who we are and not let one person pull us one way and another person another way and another person mm-hmm. another way.
Okay.
And it's interesting, and then life isn't boring.
Yeah. Well, look at Romans 14, verse 1. There's an interesting verse there that I want you to look at, and then I'm going to ask you to compare it with another verse. Romans 14, verse 1. My Good News translation says, "Welcome those who are weak in faith, but do not argue with them about their personal opinions." So does that mean that if we all have different opinions, it really doesn't matter? What's a personal opinion and what's a firm belief?
Well, the first thing that hits me when I heard you read that is that when you can get two people arguing over something where it gets to be my team against your team and the truth goes out the window. I've seen that happen so much, and sometimes I even get involved with that. And so I think you've got to handle it in such a way that people are staying connected as they're, you know, showing each other their ideas,
mm-hmm.
you know.
It's interesting that the same person who wrote those words just a short time before that wrote these words in Galatians 1, 8 and 9. Look at those, Galatians 1, 8 and 9. And here Paul, who wrote both of these books, says, "But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach to you a gospel," now would this be an opinion, an idea? "A gospel that is different from the one we preach to you, may he be condemned to hell. We have said it before, and now I say it again, if anyone preaches to you a gospel that is different from the one you accepted, may he be condemned to hell." But I favor differences
wow.
of opinion.
But the first part of Romans 14:1 says, those who are weak in faith.
Okay.
When Paul was writing to the Galatians, was he talking to the weak in faith?
What does it sound like?
Well, it sounds like they probably were very strong in their opinions and were not so weak.
Okay. Is that what makes this different?
Was the first one talking about what you said, opinion, and this is talking about the gospel, which is the truth?
Well, interestingly enough, in a larger sense, these are both talking about the same thing.
Okay.
And I don't want to get into it in a great deal, but Romans 14 goes along with 1 Corinthians 8 and 10, and it's a discussion of whether or not it's all right for a Christian to eat food that has been offered to idols. Whether it's a sin to actually partake of this. Are you showing reverence for that idol when you eat that food which has one time been offered to that idol? And Paul will say, we know perfectly well that that idol doesn't amount to anything. It hasn't changed the food in any way. If your faith is strong, you can eat that food. Well, the argument was between the people that Paul was promoting, the ideas that Paul was promoting, the fairly liberal ideas, as they would be considered, and his Jewish, conservative Jewish group that he came from. People from that group said, oh, no. That food has been offered to idols. When we come over here to Galatians, what we find is this. Paul went there. He preached the gospel to the Galatians. They apparently accepted it. They were happy. They were excited. They were delighted to learn this gospel. And then when Paul left, these same Jewish kind of people came back in and were trying to tell the people, no, you can't be a Christian unless you're a Jew first. You've got to be circumcised. You've got to keep all the rules, da-da-da-da-da. So in a sense, these are both still talking about the same kind of thing. Do we go with the very conservative, mean you've got to do all those old rules, or do you go with the more liberal? And over here in Galatians, Paul says, you learned the right way, and if you go back, you deserve to be condemned to hell.
But he doesn't say, go and tell that other person that's doing that, that they're wrong.
But Paul goes and tells them that they're wrong.
But that's different.
He's talking to as you would talk to a child. Don't you touch that hot stove, because you're going to get burned. Well, if they follow another gospel, they're going to get in trouble. They're going to...
Now, you know, my take on this is that Paul came and explained to them what the gospel was. Mm-hmm. He went through the whole thing and even says in the beginning here that before your eyes, Jesus was crucified before your eyes. Mm-hmm. That's your eyes, that you understood it, you know what he was doing. Now these other people come in, by their authority, they were saying that this isn't right, this isn't right, this isn't right. So he's saying that you got to go by with your experience and what you've understood, not by what somebody comes in and tells you it's supposed to be. And that's, he took that clear up to the highest level, which was an angel. If an angel came down and started doing that to you, you know, you shouldn't be doing that.
Well, Paul was very convinced about his version of the gospel. He considered this business about whether or not you eat meat offered to idols more or less peripheral. And that's why he says what he does there in Romans 14. But the core of the gospel, no way. He said, I gave you the truth about the gospel, and do not give that up no matter what.
He also remembers that he learned it directly from Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus dealt with him directly.
Well, I think his presentation was way more superior than these other people.
Oh, yeah.
They were going on their authority. They were coming in with their robes and their background. They were Jewish people. And this is the way you need to do it. You need to do it this way. It was the authority thing that was really, that's the difference between these two ideas. One was being taken by authority. The other one was taken from the truth, given by good explanation, good thinking, you know, explanations that just are very deep.
And Paul had learned from the same material that those other speakers had.
That's right.
Those other teachers.
He'd been there.
Yes, but now he remodeled it with his teaching, learning from Jesus. Mm-hmm. And he didn't do this. Well, one day he had a conversion experience, and now he's out there telling a story. No, he spent years on his own studying, mm-hmm. years mm-hmm. in Arabia and so forth. He didn't get pushed into the position. He grew into it. And
he didn't come in as a big Pharisee either.
No.
I mean, he came in as a humble person. He even believed that he did things that were wrong, that were shameful, and that he needed to maybe get forgiveness from people for doing this. And
that pained him the rest of his life. What he
but witnessed. There was no authority, you know, to that he gave him credentials to say what he said. It's just that when he talked about it, it made sense. Mm-hmm. And it fit everything very well.
And Paul treated both of these groups, the people in Rome that hadn't even met yet, and the people in Galatia that he was very concerned about, and the people in Corinth from which he was writing, all of them, he felt like they were family. Mm-hmm. He treated them as if they were family. Mm-hmm. Yes, Gordon.
Tell me, how does this relate to health and healing?
Well, I was going to try to pull that together.
Okay.
We are living in... a place like Southern California, particularly where most of us live, we are living in a world that's increasingly mixed cultures, mixed languages even, differences of opinion, all kinds of things. How do we relate to all those things? Are we able to put our arms out around those people and say, yes, we understand you as far as possible, welcome to our church? I mean, that's I think what we're trying to talk about here. A couple of people, famous people in the past, have said things like John Donne said, "No man is an island, entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main." He wrote that long time ago. Paul Tournier, in his book Escape from Loneliness, quotes a patient as saying, "There are two things you cannot do alone, marry and be a Christian." So that's an interesting thought. Can you be a Christian all by yourself?
Yeah. Well, God says, "Let us make man in our image." Mm-hmm. So God is a Christian in a group also, the Trinity.
Yes.
You can't really be a Christian. If as a Christian, your job is to convey your understanding and learn to others.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Jesus came here to do, is to convey his understanding and learning to others. So I don't see how you can do it by living in a cave.
Well, you wonder about hermits.
That's what it was.
What did they call those people that would go up in the...
Stylites?
Well, they go up into a place to worship God by themselves all the time. Monks,
yeah.
Yeah, those kind of things.
Well, some lived on the pole. Is that
where Well, they get up there where there's nobody that can ever tempt them with anything, you know, and they can be holy, you know.
Yeah.
And their way to do it is just keep away from people so they won't mess up their...
are they holy to all the world around them, or are they holy to themselves?
Holy different.
Well,
very much so.
You know, we're not all extroverts, and the world is getting rougher and rougher, and you are seeing people go into seclusion just because of the cruelness and the roughness of life. And as long as they could treat the animals kindly, they could learn about creation, they could, if they do happen to meet a person, treat them kindly. I don't think a Christian has to be surrounded with people. I think you can withdraw from the world and still be a Christian in a limited way.
For a time. It's hard to witness all by yourself.
Yes. Some people don't have the mental capacity to deal with society.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. And I don't think God condemns them for it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, talking about being around other people, and Christians and how they should witness, there's a very challenging verse found in John 13. Let me read 34 and 35 to get a little bit of context. The real verse is verse 35. But look at John 13, 34 and 35. And again, I'm going to read from the Good News Translation. "And now I give you a new commandment, love one another." Well, that sounds like an old commandment. That's back from from Leviticus 19:18. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. Now, that might be a new commandment. To love as Jesus did, that might be new. If you have love for one another, then everyone will know that you are my disciples. How is that possible? Excuse me. Is it really true that people of the world are so unloving that if a Christian is really loving, he just sticks out like a sore thumb?
Yes.
I think so.
Yes.
The answer is yes.
Thank you. Well, how many people do you know like that?
You mean that are unloving or that stick out like a sore thumb?
Stick out like a sore thumb.
Unfortunately, not that many.
Yeah, well...
Well, there might be some people that do, but you're so used to them. Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful to be around gentle, kind, wonderful people. And I don't know if they stick out like a sore thumb, but it's just nice being around some people who have learned how to be a Christian.
Well, we were made, obviously, for being together. Husbands with wives, wives with husbands, and families, and so forth like this. The angels were not made like that, as far as we know. One of my favorite authors says human beings were a new and distinct order. They were made in the image of God, and it was the Creator's design that they should populate the earth. We have the ability to procreate, which apparently angels don't have, and we don't know if any other beings in any other worlds had that ability to procreate. Does that mean that we have special needs for interrelatedness and friendship? Does it mean when we get to heaven, we really won't need to be close friends with anybody? We're going to be like the angels, right?
We're so far from God's design. He wanted us a certain way.
You didn't have to be quite so blunt.
He wanted us to create little people like he created people. And what do? We abort them.
Yeah.
I mean, and then men and women marry each other.
Well, maybe we shouldn't have created them to start out with.
Anyway, it's a little hard to imagine because we're so far from where God created us.
I'm not so sure to say that angels aren't close together. They may be very close. It's just that they don't result in offspring. Mm-hmm. You know, they may result in something else, but not what we're doing. Mm-hmm.
Well, and that raises the next big question that I think we need to think about. Where are people in our day supposed to learn love?
Well, I've heard you say in the family.
Isn't that what's supposed to happen?
Where
do you learn about loving if you don't learn it at home?
A lady got crucified by saying it takes a village. If you don't have a loving family, it does take a village. Then you learn it from other people.
That's
she's
hard.
Now in political office, but she...
That's hard.
If you don't learn it at home, should you then learn it at church?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Amongst your brothers and sisters? Mm-hmm. And are they really your brothers and sisters if you don't learn to love them and respect and honor them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is tough. I mean, Paul clearly said, and I mean, look at the very earliest history of the church. They basically put all their money together, put all their food together, they lived together, they were in the upper room together. I mean, and we say, we're not quite ready for that. That's a little extreme.
You know, the family is very important because I know when I had students, if a student... their personality, their problems, whatever. I could almost look past the student and see the kind of family they came from. And I admired the families so much that had together students that thought mature. And you could just really tell when there was a loving, supporting family. Now, it didn't happen all the time because the kids can get involved in drugs. Mm. And then a loving, supporting family is just torn apart. But you could really tell. And sometimes you would deal with a kid a certain characteristic that you couldn't take in class, and so you would call the parent in for a conference, and there would be the same characteristic in the parent, such as cussing or something, you know, and you go, oh, dear, you know. Mm-hmm. But so a loving family does really create loving kids.
Okay, and that's the way it should be.
But you kind of ask the question, where does love come from
yeah.
in the first place? The same question could be thrown out, where does hate come from? You know, it's kind of a, where do you point to the source? Mm-hmm. I mean, where does the source of those things? It's not very clear if you didn't have the Bible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Isaiah 45:7. Mm-hmm. Says, I create light, I create darkness, I make wheel, I make bow, I'm God, I do all these things. So ultimately, you have to run it all back to God. The capacity to love is the capacity to hate.
Yeah.
And that means choose. Mm-hmm. Choose. Well, without choice, you don't have love.
You have to have the extremes to know one or the other,
right.
too.
Yeah.
So,
well, in the beginning, he didn't want us to know, what did he say, good and evil? He didn't want us...
to know evil.
He didn't want it to be necessary for us to know good and evil, but we chose to.
Well, at least not from this tree, anyway.
I'm reminded of the story told about the man who was praying for his family, and he says, bless me and my wife, my son John and his wife, us four and no more.
Yeah.
Talk about self-centered.
Okay. Well, and that brings us to our next question. When we talk about the church, does the church really teach us to reach out and put our arms around people who are different than we are? Or is the church a very nice club? We all sort of sit together and we're all dressed the same and we speak the same language and we think alike and we march in lockstep.
Well, the church
not
has to have
to
God.
Not if you go to a board meeting.
The church has to have God in it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you can have a group without God, and who knows what you'll get. But, you know, people look at life, they're trying to find God, they're trying to find miracles and all these, you know, and all kinds of things, you know, that they can watch and look at and
yeah.
talk about. But the miracles kind of happen when people get together,
mm-hmm.
you know. When people get together, that's when you see God, and that's when you see Satan also.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, you know, when you get this community together, mm-hmm. that's where the action is.
Mm-hmm. I believe that.
So,
yeah. But isn't that a natural... I mean, I looked at the experience of 9/11 mm-hmm. and what it did to the United States. You know, we are a vast group of different factions. But 9/11 hit, and you saw people standing on the street arm in arm with people that they couldn't talk to the day before because they were angry with them about something.
Mm-hmm.
But together they were, you know, you would hope that we could hang on to that togetherness and that you would find that in the church. Mm-hmm. That would be the place you could go, and it would always be there.
Mm-hmm.
You're
could
accepted for whatever.
Could the church actually live out the principles of 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter? What would happen?
I would like to restate that. The church will live that out
mm-hmm.
before
someday.
Jesus comes.
Mm-hmm. And there's nothing that will make Satan matter.
There's a camaraderie in a goal. Like 9/11 was a horrible goal. But the church is to have a wonderful goal. And working together, hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder, to implement God's action plan should bring us close together and in a loving relationship as we march forth.
Paul particularly, but also John and Peter, say a lot of things about doing things together and what we're supposed to do when we are together. Look at some of these examples. Romans 15:7. We are to accept one another as Christ accepts us. Ephesians 4:32. I'm sorry, I'm going to jump through these fairly quickly. We are to forgive one another. Colossians 3:13. We are not only to forgive, but we are supposed to be tolerant to others. 1 Thessalonians 4:18. We should also encourage one another in living the Christian life. James 5:16. When we are wronged, when we have wronged others, we should confess those sins to one another. 1 Peter 3:8 and 4:9, Peter suggests we should love and be kind to one another, even opening our homes to each other. And John says that we should have fellowship with one another at all times, 1 John 1:7. So these three, and these, I mean, the three of those wrote most of the New Testament, if you put them together. About the only one that's not represented here is Jude and Luke, I guess. They're saying, hey, the Christian experience is all about togetherness. Seems like. Bear one another's burdens, Galatians, and so forth.
Well, I don't understand that tolerance, because just a moment ago you said, if someone comes and teaches you another gospel, tell them to go to hell. Mm-hmm. And then he's saying, be tolerant of other people. So there has to be a line where you're tolerant but firm in your convictions. Mm-hmm. So
where is that line? Mm-hmm. How do we? Well, clearly Paul was convinced that he understood the gospel. Mm-hmm. And he was not prepared to move an inch on the gospel.
He knew
there were some things that he considered a little more peripheral. And he said, okay, let's sit down, let's understand it. One person's going to think this way, somebody else is going to think like that. That's okay. You know, be tolerant of each other. But when it came to the gospel, now we're not negotiating the gospel. Mm-hmm. The gospel is, that's what it is, and it's not going to change. And I'm not going to stand for anybody trying to change it.
He wouldn't have had a following either if he'd have been wishy-washy on the issue. He's knew where he stood, and he wasn't going to equivocate on it. He would just let it hang out there.
Okay.
People don't follow it if that wasn't the case.
How do we get experience in loving the unlovable? That shouldn't be the case at home, should it?
Have a family.
Have a teenager.
It shouldn't be the case at home.
Certainly not your teenager.
No, not mine. Well, they're not anymore, so it's okay.
It often is the case. Uh-huh. Because you're around them so much. Mm-hmm. Are you going to give us an answer to that?
Well, you know, Jesus said even the taxpayers and the Pharisees love their friends, mm-hmm. you know. So he didn't give us much credit for loving our friends.
Okay, is it that you need to be kind to those people? I mean, it's hard to love them, but you should act as if you love them and you were kind, and maybe eventually you will love them in a way. But if they keep persecuting you and doing horrible things, it's difficult.
Okay, let me try a test case. You're driving your car, you go off the ramp, and you're standing there, you got to wait for quite a while to get a chance to either turn right or left. And here's a guy standing with a sign that says, "Why lie? I need a dollar for a drink." Would Jesus give him the dollar?
Jesus might touch him and say, "You're healed."
Mm-hmm. But you can't do that?
I can't.
That's not fair. It's like, who's this little kid that's Dennis the Menace, I guess? There's one Dennis Menace cartoon showed that he's running into the house with a bunch of friends behind him, and there's one piece of cake sitting on the table, and he's about to grab it. His mother says, "Hold on, what would Jesus do?" And Dennis the Menace says, "He'd make 500 pieces of cake." So it's not fair to put Jesus in doing something that we can't do, right?
Did Jesus say you're supposed to help yourself? I know in the past I've been kind of feisty and run into some of those people. And I was a work experience teacher. And I tried to discuss with them how they should go and apply for a job. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm. But so I make a pretty good living at that. So that kind of is a kind of a poor example. You know, we think that somebody in need, we should help them. But then when you've seen them, what kind of a car they get into when they're leaving that post on a daily basis, and what kind of lifestyle they have. I'm not saying they're all that way, but it kind of ruins it for those who you perceive that really do have a need.
Yeah. So I like those missions that are in the downtown areas that come. They have to listen to a sermon, mm-hmm. sing some songs, and then they give them some food. Mm-hmm. And I really think those places are precious.
Okay. Let me ask another question. Have you ever had the experience of doing something for someone and you know that there's no way they are ever going to be able to do anything back for you? And you do something really nice for them. And maybe it happens once in a while. You do something really nice for them and you walk away feeling really good. Why do you feel so good?
Silence.
Maybe we've never had that experience.
You feel good.
Is that a touch of God in us? Because we do feel good when we've done something like that. What is that in us?
Well, is that God
That's
in us?
That's not sin.
Or are we just so proud of ourselves?
Did you do it for a self-centered reason?
Or is it the realization that you've done what is right? Uh-huh.
Yeah? Well, how good are Christians in general at reaching out to the lonely? How many people in our world are really lonely? I will have to say, I work at a clinic for people who don't have insurance and have had a rough life, a lot of them, a really rough life. And they don't have money. They live barely from one hand to the next, you know, one paycheck next, if they get a paycheck. And I find that if you treat them really nicely, which I try to every day, there's some of them who come back even when they really don't need to see me, because I think at the clinic they found a home. Mm-hmm. They say, and here is a place where I can go and people are nice to me. Mm-hmm. And it should be like that. That's the way the church ought to be.
At the other end of the spectrum, there are the super rich mm-hmm. who are often lonely, mm-hmm. and they will go on a shopping spree because the sales clerks treat them nicely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talking about ways in which the church can reach out to the lonely, can you think of some ways that church, how would you... Can you drive down the street and tell who's lonely? How should they? I mean, if we're suggesting that the lonely might be a good group to sort of reach out to, how can we reach them?
I'm under the impression that the majority of people are probably lonely.
So you could just start knocking on doors.
You might not get a good reception that way, but they're probably lonely. Mm-hmm. Those who don't have a church community to go to, or some other organization that they're a part of.
One suggestion that has been used in the past and very successfully is that churches sometimes will join one of these community groups. There's in almost any large community, they have these things called Welcome Wagon or something like that, and they keep track. They make a list, a recurring list of all the people who've recently moved into the community. And when you move from somewhere to a new place and you don't really know many people, that's a time when people are particularly likely to make changes in their lifestyle and their whatever, and it's a great time for a church to reach out and bring somebody in. And, I mean, that's an example. I'm just giving that as an example. Maybe a time when we could reach out to people.
Churches can have lots of things. They can have their get-togethers, they can have their mm-hmm. potlucks, they can have group discussion, they can have bowling nights, some churches have. I don't know if the Adventist church has. But many things that they can notify the community mm-hmm. about, that here's something, if you want to come and be with people, here's something you can come to. Mm-hmm. And that's a great help.
Sure. Yeah. That's a good idea.
When you're trying to help somebody, which that's what we're discussing right now, mm-hmm. you've got to understand their need. Mm-hmm. You know that they need something, but sometimes you can't identify it. And you can talk to them for a while and see, you know, what it is, but you still may not know what it is.
Yeah.
And so it's not automatic. Yeah. You can't just come out and say, I'm going to help that person, because it may be a hit or miss, you know, as far as being able to do anything for them, mm-hmm. you know.
One of the groups that we maybe have the hardest time reaching out to in our day are the youth, especially the ones that are inclined to get involved in gangs and so forth. Has the church ever had any success in reaching out to those people? How should we reach out to young people that are, you know, maybe moving to the periphery of the church group? Even ones who started out and grew up in the church.
Well, how do you convince them of values? Mm-hmm. I mean, what's valuable and what isn't valuable? Sometimes they just got to go out and figure it out for themselves. You're just going to have to
kill
wait.
Themselves in the process.
That's right, but what else can you do? I mean,
I think you make healthy areas for them to be. A basketball gym, mm-hmm. have those basketball games, have this activity. It doesn't have to be church related, but the church can provide a healthy atmosphere. And this type of activity does not tolerate, you can't smoke here, you can't do this there, or whatever. And the kids will come, they will feel safe. But the churches often don't do it because it's not a group that brings money. Mm-hmm. And it's expensive to provide for. Mm-hmm. But just a safe environment is what the kids need, a safe, where they can get together in a safe environment.
I'm sure there's no church in the world, certainly no church in North America, that hasn't experienced the disadvantages of not doing something. I mean, when our young people...
Is there your future?
Yeah, when young people start wandering away from the church because the church is not reaching them, is not putting their arms around them, that's serious.
But, you know, not all people, all kids are looking for safety. I mean, they just have a value system that they're just going to have to find out whether or not it's really worth it or not.
You'd be surprised.
And it takes time. Well, I know some people, they're rich. I had some friends. I talked to them about, you know, religion and that kind of thing, and it just didn't want to have anything to do with it.
No, I'm not
And these guys were miserable. They were miserable.
I'm not talking...
And yet they didn't want to... I mean, Ken's asking generally here. You might be talking about one group, but I'm talking about another group. Mm-hmm. But it seems like, you know, they're all looking for values, the right value. They're going after what they think is value. Mm-hmm. When you're a Christian... And you're settled into your Christianity, you know where your value is. It's in Jesus. And how in the world do you convey that to other people unless you can relate to them somehow? And if you can't at the moment, you may have to wait until somebody else can do it. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Part of the problem is that we as church members easily can feel very comfortable among our peers. And if someone starts behaving, even if it's someone that we know should belong to our group, they start behaving differently, they do some things we're not happy about, it's a lot easier for us to say, you know, stay away, instead of saying, let me put my arm around you, brother. Is there something you'd like to do? Can we play a basketball game together? Can we, you know, whatever it happens to be, can we do something together to make you feel a part of us? That's tough.
That's no better than the tribes of the ancient world or the gangs that wear red bandanas or blue bandanas. And in your church group, the minute someone does a little something different, they're out of the tribe. And so Jesus is asking us not to act like tribal warfare or gang warfare. And
remember earlier I said scientific research has shown that people who can reach out and pull into their group, people who are different than they are happier than the people who, even if they have a lot of friends, that are pretty much like they are.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically saying that, you know, our job is to strike up a relationship with people, start building on that somehow, mm-hmm. like Jesus did with his disciples. Mm-hmm. When they started out, you know what the disciples were like. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he was resurrected, they got it completely then.
Yeah.
I mean, he was their God. He was their value. He was everything.
Yeah.
And at that point, they started acting differently.
In the book Ministry of Healing, there are these words that gives us some hint about Jesus. Many feel that it would be a great privilege to visit the scenes of Christ's life on earth, to walk where he trod, to look upon the lake beside which he loved to teach, and the hills and valleys on which his eyes so often rested. And I can say it's a privilege. I have been there, traveling back and forth to my mission work in Africa. But we need not go to Nazareth, to Capernaum, or to Bethany in order to walk in the steps of Jesus. We shall find his footprints beside the sickbed, in the hovels of poverty, in the crowded alleys of the great cities, and in every place where there are human hearts in need of consolation. We are to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and comfort the suffering and afflicted. We are to minister to the despairing and to inspire hope in the hopeless. The love of Christ, manifest in an unselfish ministry, will be more effective in reforming the evildoer than will the sword or the court of justice. These are necessary to strike terror to the lifebreaker, to the lawbreaker. We need those forces. But the loving missionary can do more than this. Often the heart that hardens under reproof will melt under the love of Christ. And those words are quite remarkable, in my opinion. They really send us a message. In this series of lessons, we have learned many things about health, everything from diet to friendships to the importance of water, the importance of exercise, etc. And in this series, we have learned ways in which we can enjoy better health. The Bible talks about these. There are many aspects. And in today's lesson, we have seen how important a part it is to just get along with other people, learn to put your arms around them in a spiritual sense at least, and to try to pull them into your group. And churches that are successful in growing and expanding and spreading the gospel have learned how to put their arms around other people that are not exactly like they are. This relationship, this reaching out, goes along with a view that we've called the larger view, a great controversy trust healing model of salvation. And we hope that you've come to understand a little more about it through this series of lessons we've had on the subject of health. God bless you.